Dr. Ken Hansen is an author, lecturer, founder of Treasures in Time, an organization devoted to disseminating knowledge of the biblical and classical world. He has dug on archaeological sites in the Middle East, lived in a politically volatile region of northern Galilee, and taught Hebrew on an Israeli agricultural settlement. He also worked with a television news gathering operation in a war zone in southern Lebanon at the height of the Civil War that left the jewel of the Mediterranean in ruins. Having been up close and personal with the face of terrorism, Dr. Hansen lends a timeless perspective to the challenges of the future. He currently serves at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, where he teaches courses on Jewish history from ancient times through the 20th century, including the rise of Israel and the Holocaust. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Ken, how are you? Good to have you back.
Good to be back, George, and warm shalom from the heart of Central Florida.
I have to ask you about this uproar in the Catholic Church with the Da Vinci Code. First of all, a higher-up in the Vatican has told people not to read the book, not to buy it. And then another archbishop in South America said, no, this bishop was talking on his own. He wasn't sanctioned by the church. Are you up to speed on any of that, Ken? What's going on there?
Well, it's kind of paradoxical, to say the least, because in the first place, we're dealing with fiction, and everybody knows that this is a fictional piece. It's a novel, but it's based upon a lot of investigation that's been done over years. It's based on some other material. One book is called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and that is really the kernel of research from which the Da Vinci Code sprung. Now, the trouble that the Vatican obviously has with a book like this, with a novel like this, is the fact that it does fly in the face of traditional Catholic teaching about Jesus being forever celibate. He was married to the church, mm-hmm. in the eyes of the church. So one can imagine how threatening, how incendiary the very ideas presented in this novel and in the earlier book would be. The idea that Jesus consorted with Mary Magdalene and produced a child by her. The paradox is that the book, that is the novel, is both not so trustworthy and somewhat trustworthy at the same time.
Well, it's like fiction, nonfiction at the same time, right?
It's fiction, nonfiction. But specifically, the closer one comes to the present time in this novel, the things that are related about Opus Dei, for example, this secretive Catholic organization, the closer one approaches to the present time in this novel, the less trustworthy it becomes. Opus Dei really is not what the novel makes it out to be. However, the farther back you go in time, into antiquity, the more plausible some of these ideas and some of these theories become. Especially, for example, with Mary Magdalene, when we have an ancient text, mm-hmm. which declares, and I'm quoting it, "And the companion, Mary Magdalene, he loved her more than all the disciples, and used to kiss her often on her mouth." My goodness.
My goodness, indeed.
Here is an apocryphal text that most people don't even know existed. It's been around for a long time, and yet there it is in black and white. What do you do with a text like that? It's not something you find in traditional Gospels, but it's there nonetheless. So this is not just hanging on thin air, especially when you go far back into antiquity.
Now, this text, I mean, do people who are scholars like you, do they know about this?
Sure, but don't quite know what to do with it. And the beauty of being a scholar is that you really don't have to spin theology. That's why I'm not a theologian, right? You just look at the facts that are at hand, and you say, here they are. This is what we have. It's up to individuals to interpret them. Do you take this text at its face value, or do you decide, I really don't trust it, essentially? Nobody can say that. This is an individual, this is a personal decision. But we can highlight the texts themselves tell people where they come from, give a little bit of a sense about them so that hopefully people can come to their own conclusions.
Ken, how do we know that all these ancient texts and the Bible and everything that we have read from the ancients wasn't just a made-up story by some great authors of the time?
Yeah, well, oddly enough, a lot of scholars assume just that, not just about these extraneous texts that never quite made it into the Bible, but about the Bible itself. This is a very heated debate in the halls of academe. How much of the Bible can be trusted in terms of even the authorship? Did Moses, for example, really write the books of Moses? Did somebody else write them and just describe them to Moses? And that's only the tip of the iceberg. How many Isaiahs are there? One, two, three, more? It goes on and on. It's endless. So if you're going to examine the books of the traditional Bible in that way, well, hey, here's extraneous books we ought to throw into the mix as well. Why not?
Absolutely. What do you think happened 2,000 years ago on this planet, in that area that, of course, is so controversial today?
Well, I like to tell my students the more things change, the more they stay the same. People had metaphysical experience, just as people have metaphysical experiences today. Human beings are human beings, and however far back into the past we go, we find that people have a sense that there is something more than just flesh and blood, something more than just this material realm. The greatest mystery in the universe is the universe itself. Why do we exist? Or as Stephen Hawking puts it, why did the universe go to all the trouble of existing?
and
far back as you go, people have struggled with this and have had metaphysical experience. Many have claimed to have had out-of-body experience. Some of these experiences sound like extraterrestrial encounters. The kind of things that people report today are exactly what the ancients reported. That's the amazing thing. So that when we look at people's experience today, before we just cavalierly dismiss them, we ought to consider what the ancients wrote about, what they related, and there are many amazing such encounters that are related, not only in the Bible, people think it just stops with the Bible itself, but in these extra books, 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago.
Let's talk a little bit, Ken, about some of the work you've done into these lost texts. How were they found?
Well, they've always been around. Some of them have been found only in the 20th century, but the bulk of them have been around. It's just that most people never knew they existed, myself included. I went over to the Middle East as a young undergraduate student, a history student, determined just to explore, find out what I can about the roots of Western thought and culture. I ended up digging into the Dead Sea Scrolls, an amazing cache of ancient parchments discovered in the middle of the 20th century, determined to find out what the reality is behind the Dead Sea Scrolls. And sure enough, I encountered these extraneous books, books that never made it into the Bible. We have fragments of these books that feature prominently among the Dead Sea Scrolls, 2,000 years old. Now, these books, most of them were originally composed in Hebrew and Aramaic between 2,000 and 3,000 years ago. But the originals were in most cases lost, and that's why I call this stuff the Lost Bible. The originals were lost. They were not recopied. They were deliberately suppressed in most instances by self-righteous clerics and sages and religious leaders, and were only copied by a few monks here and there in other languages, such as Greek or Coptic. So really, we're dealing with a whole treasure trove of these lost books that I discovered, could not help but discover. I like to say I didn't find them, they found me, and just took hold of me, and I began to dig into them. Again, they've been around. Most of them have been known for the last two millennia, but only by scholars, only by a few clerics here and there. The rank and file have never even heard of these books. And some of them, as I mentioned, were discovered Only in the middle of the 20th century, one entire cache found in a town in Egypt called Nag Hammadi, found by an Egyptian farmer, turned out to be one of the most important archaeological finds in all of history.
Now, were the contents known as well, beyond just finding the texts?
With the books that we knew about, yes, the contents were known. For example, I'll give you an example, the Book of Jubilees. This was known to have existed all along, but we never had an original. We only had copies of copies, and those translated from Hebrew, Aramaic into Greek, other languages, Coptic, and so on. So, to all intents and purposes, people could not relate to these books, even though we knew they existed. But the cache found in Egypt at Nag Hammadi, these were entire books we never knew existed before.
What were they written on, Ken?
They were written on papyrus, on codices, as they're called, stuffed into pottery jars. When this farmer named Muhammad Ali, can you imagine?
Really? Yeah, that's right.
In 1945, out in his field, stumbled upon these pottery jars, and inside were 13 codices of wadded up papyri, essentially, containing entire books, gospels, especially gospels that we never knew existed before.
What are the possibilities that there are other texts out there somewhere in other farmers' fields, who knows where, in caves, they haven't been discovered, that could just shake the foundation of everything we understand?
Well, scholars are notorious skeptics, myself included, and we like to think, well, we've found just about everything
that can be found yeah.
Until all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, somebody finds something else. So I have to hedge on this and say it is entirely possible. In fact, just a few years ago, the State of Israel mounted an archaeological expedition on the shores of the Dead Sea to find out if any more Dead Sea Scrolls, in fact, might be out there hidden away in these caves. And there's another parallel cache of material, not unlike what was found in Egypt in the middle of the 20th century, found along the shores of the Dead Sea, a whole library of ancient parchments. Israel mounted an expedition, an Indiana Jones type of expedition, to see if they could find more. It didn't turn up anything. That does not mean that there is not more out there. I think it's entirely possible.
If there are more, what's left of the story that hasn't been revealed? I mean, what more could someone have written about? Maybe it would just be corroborating stories, for example. They might say the same thing, but in a different way, a different style. Or would it be so different, so far-fetched, that it would just make you go, my gosh?
Sometimes these stories are, in fact, my gosh kind of stories. They really are mind-blowing, and especially on the metaphysical end of it, relating journeys into heaven, for example, out-of-body experience. Some people would make them akin to alien encounters, seriously.
Right.
It's just that phenomenal. One text from the Dead Sea Scrolls describes an ascent up into the heavenly temple, accompanied by angelic songs, mirroring the worship going on down here on the earth. It's only a copy, a mirror image of a heavenly worship in this divine realm, and the witness is literally taken up above the earth into that celestial temple, accompanied by angels. I mean, who would imagine such a thing would be found? Now, there are rumors, in fact, of yet another similar type of text, having to do with an angelic encounter, mm-hmm. being taken up through a series of seven heavens. There are rumors of such a text existing. They have not yet been corroborated.
If they exist, where might they be?
There was rumor, for example, that this text made its way to a monastery, I believe, in the heart of Europe, and then yet it was never produced.
Ah.
So we don't know at this point. But there are enough rumors out there to think that it might not be just so much fancy. There really might be something to this, and to other rumors as well.
Well, I've always wondered, too, Ken, that some people who are so wealthy that will spend $40, $50, $60 million on artwork, if they knew these existed, they would pay that kind of money just to keep it, just to have it, just to say to themselves, sure, my gosh, look what I have.
Absolutely.
And I think that's possible.
Sure, sure. I mean, these have potentially such astounding impact for the Christian world, also for the Jewish world, especially in the realm of mysticism, so-called Kabbalah, of which there is quite a bit in this lost Bible.
If all these stories we've heard of godlike figures and issues like that turned out to be interpreting an extraterrestrial visitation or ongoing extraterrestrial visitations, would that shake the foundation of religion, or would it add to it? Maybe they just merely misinterpreted what they saw. Maybe they weren't angels. Maybe they were aliens. Maybe it wasn't, as you say, a temple in the sky. It was a UFO, a craft of some sort.
Well, that's the beauty of being a scholar. Again, you don't have to come to such conclusions. What we can say is, here is the text. Here is what it says. You can interpret it as you will. And sure enough, some of these do lend themselves to precisely that kind of interpretation. People are generally familiar with the book of Ezekiel,
yes,
which is in traditional Bibles, and this incredible experience that sounds like an alien encounter. But we have others. We have a story of Abraham, for example, who we're told in this non-biblical text called the Testament of Abraham, we're told that he is lifted up through means of some kind of angelic visitation, but he's lifted up above the surface of the earth and taken across it so that he can look down and see things that are going on the earth underneath him. What is this? Is this an ancient person describing in the best way he can what we would call a close encounter with an alien presence? As scholars, we can't weigh in on that. We can just say, here's the text. Hey, it lends itself to multiple interpretations.
Does Dr. Ken Hansen have a personal view on what this might be?
Oh, dear. If I did, I would probably be reluctant to say.
I can't squeeze it out of you this time. Right?
Maybe. We'll
see.
I'll meditate on that,
okay,
for a little while.
Because I have a feeling you have a view on this. I'm not wrong about that.
You're right.
Yeah, okay. The as we get close to Easter in the story of the resurrection, it has always fascinated me, Ken, since I was a boy growing up, because I kept trying to say, how could this happen? How could something like this occur? And they move a rock out of the way, and there's no body, it's gone. And then if the Shroud of Turin is indeed authentic, and it might be, what a great, tremendous story. What happened during this period? I would love to have lived then. I bet you would, too.
Oh, my. As a matter of fact, well, that period of time is called the Second Temple period in Judaism, in the Jewish world. And to my way of thinking, it's the most fascinating, incredible period of history ever to have transpired, because it does indeed lay the groundwork for the whole modern world, the Western world as we know it, for the three dominant monotheistic faiths of the Western world. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all came directly out of this cauldron of incredible creative spiritual activity. And once again, bragging on scholarship, since we don't have to form religious conclusions per se, we can simply trot this stuff out and sit down at a common table from varying religious backgrounds and say, these are the texts, here's what we have, without trying to hit each over the head saying, my religion is better than yours.
Exactly.
We're all trying to simply understand the text that we have and maybe solve maybe one more little part of this mystery.
When we come back, let's talk about miracles, Ken, and just get your take on what you think they might have been. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Ken Hansen. Ken, miracles, they've occurred since the beginning of time. What do you think they are? Why do you think they occur? I mean, are they controlled by people who have certain mystical powers, or do they just happen by chance?
My, have you asked a loaded question, George? How many hours do we have for this?
Yeah, really? Lots.
Oh, my goodness. So how do we even begin to talk about miracles? okay, I'm a believer in miracles, even though I'm an academician and try to pull my punches as much as possible and not tell people what to believe, but nonetheless, absolutely. And the amazing thing is that you find stories of miracles in all of the great religious traditions. You look back into this amazing historical period we've been talking about, the Second Temple period, and there are miracles galore. Not only do we find miracles in the New Testament, but there are stories of ancient Jewish sages, rabbis, who went around with healing powers. It was really incredible. This could not have come about just by someone making wild reports, unsubstantiated. As I said before, human beings are who they are across time, and just as people report miraculous healings, recoveries, and so on in our own time, so did they in antiquity. So these texts are extremely valuable on that level. And let me also point out something that Jesus of Nazareth said vis-a-vis his main message, the kingdom of heaven. Huge mistake people make when they think about the kingdom of heaven. Ask anybody and they'll tell you this is the future, this is the end of the world, when the kingdom of heaven comes. Well, frankly, this is a rabbinic term that we find in Judaism. We find this in the Talmud. We find that this kingdom is a Jewish expression for a present tense fullness of life on a metaphysical level. To be whole, to be well, whatever your problem is, whatever bugs you, to be whole and well right here and now. Not the hereafter, but the here and now. The kingdom of heaven is present tense. And that's why, in the standpoint of Jesus of Nazareth, the miracles he performed are not something you can just put on the side, as some scholars in history have done, like Albert Schweitzer, who tried to rewrite the story of Jesus with no miracles. In the end, you have no historical Jesus, because those miracles are essential to discovering the historical person. But the same is true with other sages, rabbis, as I mentioned, in ancient times, miracle stories galore. There's another level of miracles, however, where I have to hesitate. And let me just stress that metaphysics is by nature non-literal. And people can get themselves into a whole lot of trouble, back themselves into a corner, when they try to look at figurative language in an overly literal way. And that is, frankly, what I think we're looking at when it comes to some
of the miracle
stories, especially some of the more violent ones. And people are really, really bothered when they read the Bible and they find stories about little ones being dashed against the rocks and all in the name of God. This sounds like a jihad. This is problematical. But at that point, you have to step back from the text. And you have to ask, now wait a second, beyond anything happening literally, what's the message? What is the attempt here to convey to us? And that is where I get really excited. Because the message of the biblical text, both the traditional Bible and this lost Bible that I've written about, is that the universe that we inhabit is not random. It's not by chance. It's going somewhere. And in our own day and age, this is what it comes down to. Either you believe that this is all just a big machine that came about.
That just happened.
That just happened. Either you believe that that's all there is, a big bang, perhaps to be followed by a big crunch, or you don't accept that. You think that there is something more. You think that there is a design, that there is a beginning, and that there is an end, and that history is directional, and furthermore, the divine presence intervenes in it. That's the message of the miracles, even the violent ones. I don't look for literal reality behind some of these stories. I look for that message saying that the divine presence is intervening in human history. This is not an accident. There is a design behind everything we look at around us. It's called the anthropic principle in astrophysics, by the way. The universe could not have come about by accident.
No, I believe entirely that there was some kind of creation behind it. I don't exactly understand it, and I'm sure a lot of people can, even scholars, don't understand it. But as you say, it just didn't happen by chance. There's just too much order out there, and you can see in various star clusters and things. I mean, it's almost
Absolutely.
As if they're all alive, and,
well, yeah.
you know, and that they've got a mission. They know what to do. It's strange.
Well, the universe seems to have been designed deliberately to bring forth life and intelligent life. And the chances, just looking at it from the standpoint of science and astrophysics, the chances that the order we see would have come about by itself are infinitesimally small, minute. After the Big Bang, honestly, we should have had just a gaseous, nebulous fog, nothing like the order that we see.
You know, Ken, the things you talk about, which really strike nerves on so many people, because I think that's one of the driving forces beyond people who, you know, go home and they have dinner with their families and they have to wake up in the morning and they go to work or they work the night shift. You know, life is tough and you got to make it work. But I think through it all, there's an element now that seems to be growing in people about this thought of who am I, what am I, and what am I doing here? And I think as we get older, we begin to think about that a little bit more for obvious reasons. You know, when
sure.
we check out, we want to make sure there's a reason we're checking out. But
yeah.
but I feel it is happening more than maybe even a few years ago, and I don't know why. How about you?
Well, yeah, I think ever since the turn of the millennium especially, we have seen people focusing back and very much inward again, looking inside, looking to an inner truth, an inner reality. If you dig into this lost Bible, you'll find a golden thread, as I like to call it, that holds this material together. No matter which book you're looking at, and they're all disparate books written in different places and different times. They didn't make it into the Bible, as I mentioned, but the thing that holds them all together is the idea that we as human beings are more than what we know. We are the very stuff of deity. And that is an idea that, call it New Age, but it's very much surfaced since the turn of the millennium, underscored by the events of 9/11, and who cannot look inside and ask, who am I, what am I? I look back at the creation account in the Hebrew Bible, being a Hebrew scholar, and we're told that this creature was formed, Adam. Actually, the Hebrew word is Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who is this? Is this a male? Is this a man? I suppose.
Was he a space traveler? You know,
a space traveler, right? Is this some kind of bedtime story? How literally do we take it? When you look at the very word Adam, metaphysically, you tear it apart from its Hebrew root. You find that it's related to the word Adama, which means ground or earth. And it's related to another word, Adom, which means red, as in the red earth. And on one level, it seems to be emphasizing that all we are is dust. But you look at the same word metaphysically on a different level, and this is where the Lost Bible seems to take it. You look at that same word, and you find the root dam, blood, hidden in that word Adam. And then you find the prefix ah, the Hebrew letter Aleph in front of the Dam, and the Aleph can be short for the word Elohim, or God, God's blood. We are the very stuff of deity, and there's an innate sense of this I think in every human being, even those who try to deny it and try to cover it up. But those are the two options that you have when you look at the Bible. How are you going to look at human beings? Are you going to look at us as just so much dust in this abject misery, maybe looking for pie in the sky when we die? Or are you going to really see yourself as divine, in a sense? And that's, again, where the lost Bible tends to take you. Over and over, we have statements about the inherent divinity of the individual.
You know, when you look at all of these things and you try to interpret what they may be, and as you look at the Genesis, which is the beginning of the Bible, what goes through your mind, Ken, when you read about the fallen angels? You know, they came down to breed with daughters of man. I mean, you look at that and you're going, how could somebody make that up?
Yeah.
And then what do they mean if it's true? So as a scholar, what did they mean?
Yeah, interesting you should ask that. I noticed that one of the guests last night was talking about that very passage in the book of Genesis. You look at the passage itself, and it mentions this group of beings, whoever they are, called the Nephilim.
Mm-hmm.
It's only one verse. That's it. One verse in the Hebrew text that there were Nephilim in those days. You find one other brief verse in the book of Numbers about the Nephilim, and it invites speculation. I think these two tiny passages have invited more speculation than any in world literature, and yet you look at them and you say, what's there to go on here? Like, where's the beef?
Right,
you know?
Right. Yet it's there. It's
there.
Included.
And you have to think there's got to be something more, and sure enough, you look at these apocryphal books, the ones that didn't make it. The book of First Enoch, for example, has all manner of additional information that the Bible doesn't tell you. And there must have been a whole fund of knowledge, a whole folklore related to an angelic host. The book of Enoch calls them the Watchers. And if we read that ancient text, it says that while the sons of men multiplied, fair and lovely daughters were born to them, and the watchers, these are some angelic hosts, they're not mentioned in the Bible per se, those sons of heaven, it tells us, were attracted to them, lusted after them, and they said to one another, let's seek out the daughters of men and rear sons for ourselves. It says there were 200 of them altogether.
I mean, yeah, they were that specific in even numbers. They counted them.
Yeah, they counted them. They descended on the summit of Mount Hermon, that's in northern Galilee, during the days of Enoch's father, Yared. And then the text goes on. Elsewhere it says, the women became pregnant by the watchers and gave birth to the giants, who grew up to be 3,000 cubits tall. They were born according to the laws of nature, and grew up at a constant rate. None were able to provide for their rapacious appetites. Therefore, the Nephilim, the giants, conspired to kill the men and eat them. They conspired, in other words, to devour humankind from off the face of the earth. And the text goes on and tells us that whereas in traditional Bibles the idea is that it was simply sin that caused the waters of the flood to be sent in the days of Noah, the lost Bible tells us it was the Nephilim. It was this race of hybrids, as it were, who might have destroyed humanity had it not been for the destruction of the flood waters. That was the real reason that the flood came.
To get rid of them, not us.
To get rid of it. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, this is a whole wealth of tradition that most people never even knew existed, nor could they find it in traditional Bibles.
I did not know about the passage that they were eating human beings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what I've done in my own book called Secrets from the Lost Bible is I've gone back to these original apocryphal books that never made it, and I've retranslated them into more of a flowing English, even a semi-paraphrase, so that modern people can pick this up and say, wow, you know, I didn't know this existed before, and really cuddle up with this material. Now, of course, again, as a scholar, I have to hedge a little bit, and I cannot tell you what the text means. I can just tell you what it says. Now, what people do with that is a matter of interpretation, you know, and you can take that any way you want. You can do as Zachariah Sitchin, and you can posit that, in fact, this was a whole race of aliens who came and impregnated human women.
True.
And there have, as we know, been tales of UFO abductions, alleging that men and women are taken into space,
mm-hmm.
perhaps sexually used. I noticed, again, one of your guests last night talked about some kind of sexual assault by a being. And who is this being? Who can say?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it is more than tantalizing to find ancient depictions of similar stories. As a scholar, I can't go there, as it were. But I can say, here's the text.
But you can also say something happened.
Something happened. Now you can take that literally. You can also take it on an allegorical level. And that's something I want to challenge people to do. Whatever you do with the idea of, say, an alien visitation, if you want to go there, fine. But don't miss the allegorical level in this, that if you understand even human beings as angelic, in a sense, what's really the problem that's related here is desire, lust, wanting something additional than what's inside of us. When we mix divine with flesh, we end up producing monsters, and we can make ourselves into monsters, following our own rapacious appetites, as it were, as opposed to keeping ourselves thinking the right way, meditating on the right things, on the kind of things that bring forth health and long life and this kingdom of heaven, this rabbinical term. So you can take these stories and you can internalize them as well. And let's not forget that aspect.
Does the Lost Bible talk about the devil at all, Ken?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, there's a lot having to do with Satan. The word Satan, a Hebrew word, Satan, simply means the adversary.
Okay, well, when we come back, top of the hour, let's talk about that. I also want to get your impressions of what hell is. So many people believe hell is here on planet Earth. Is it another dimension? Is it in another universe? I want to find out from you. Dr. Ken Hansen is our guest. He is a scholar, author. He's a lecturer. He is founder of Treasures in Time, his website. He's got a couple are linked up with his name right now on coasttocoastam.com, treasuresintime.org, mansionmaze.com, and we'll be back. He's got a couple great books out, Secrets from the Bible, Dead Sea Scrolls, The Untold Story. We'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Dr. Ken Hansen, who has investigated the Lost Bible. We're going to talk about the end times also. But the devil, remember the old saying, the devil made me do it, Ken.
Oh, my.
This evil that is out there. What does the Lost Bible say about the devil?
Yeah, we need a few more hours for that one as well. Now, George, as a professor, I never tell people what to think, but I just get them to think. That's the important
Fair
thing.
Fair enough.
Get them to think. So, yes, the Bible, the Lost Bible, certainly weighs in on the devil, but let me preface that by saying that ancient Judaism, from which the traditional Bible and the Lost Bible sprouted, ancient Judaism had a very hard time with the idea of a personal devil as it has today. Why? Because this is a truly monotheistic faith. And as soon as one begins to ascribe power to another being who is, in a sense, an anti-God being, then you have to ask, well, how many gods are there, one or two? So I can tell you that because the Lost Bible does make specific reference to Satan, to Satan, to the devil, that seems to be one of the reasons that these books were systematically suppressed by sages, by rabbis, banned from the Bible, as it were, because they depict what scholars call dualism as opposed to monotheism, not one God but two. Big problem for the ancients. And yet, it's there plain as day in these ancient writings, and this certainly is part of the ancient Jewish world. We have one text in particular called The Life of Adam and Eve. If you think that Genesis is the last word on the subject, think again.
Yeah,
this is
true.
A whole additional book, a whole account called The Life of Adam and Eve, coming right out of ancient Judaism, that gives us all kinds of tantalizing details about the evil one, Satan, specifically. And this point really grabs me. We're told that the reason that Satan fell and was cast out of paradise to begin with was that he was commanded at the beginning to bow down and worship Adam, and he refused. He refused to worship Adam. Now, as a metaphysician, one immediately gets excited, because what is it telling us? What is the text telling us again about the nature of human beings? We are little gods, as it were. We are the stuff of divinity. And an interesting tidbit is also found in Islam, even in Islamic art. We see depicted an evil entity called Iblis in Islam, the Islamic version of the devil, who is pictured in Islamic art standing back away from Adam, refusing to bow down and do obeisance like all the other angels. The very same tradition found its way into Islam. So you have to wonder now, what's really behind this, and how prominent was this kind of tale in the ancient world? We're told that whoever this being, this Satan was, he disguised himself as an angel in the Garden of Eden and looked over the wall. We're told that Eden had walls, by the way. And he came to Eve's half of the garden.
So it sounds like a city, almost.
It does. Yeah. It does. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Had walls, like a city. And when the angels had gone off to worship God, that was his moment to sneak over and to tempt Eve with knowledge. Knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That's the great sin. It's the desire for knowledge.
So the metaphor of this was the apple.
The metaphor is the apple. Of course, yeah. Neither the Bible, the traditional Bible, does not tell us at all what the fruit was. I was about to say neither does the Lost Bible, but then I take it back. Yes, it does. It says it was figs.
Well, where did the apple come in then? All of a sudden.
Well, that came in from centuries of subsequent religious tradition. Seemed like a nice thing to depict or put in pictures,
okay.
I'm sure. It's amazing how these stories get distorted because...
And twisted.
And because they're so brief, and students of the biblical text are immediately struck by this. The entire Bible, if you just look at it as literature, is written with a deliberate brevity. It is so crisp, so succinct, so concise, it doesn't mince words. And this is deliberate. It leaves very much to the imagination, and it forces the reader to bring something to the text. In the ancient world, you didn't just sit back and, like a sponge, soak in whatever the author wanted you to get from it. You have to do some work. You have to bring something to the text, interact with it, and that in turn helped bring forth so much of this amazing folklore that we call the Lost Bible. It's the kind of thing they would have talked about round the campfire in ancient times.
Oh, indeed.
Reams of it.
The push of evil has always fascinated me, because I've always been one to try to accent the other side, the side of good.
Right.
But there's always this give and take, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got good, you've got to have evil. You can't have one without the other, can you?
Precisely. And that's also the beauty of this story of the fall as it's told in the life of Adam and Eve. You're reading the traditional Bible, and again, it's so short. You have this harsh, petty, punitive deity. And what did Adam and Eve do? They ate a piece of fruit. The story ends. They're kicked out. In the lost Bible, it's this balance of good and evil. You can't have one without the other. Yes, there's punishment for the disobedience, but the story goes on and brings forth a whole level of compassion in the aftermath of the fall, especially as Adam, who's now stricken with 70 plagues, lay dying, and he begs that Eve and his son Seth should return to Eden for anointing oil to help him in his pain. And they go back and they make this mystical journey all the way back to Eden to try to help poor Adam with his suffering. There's this whole level of divine compassion. Without the fall, we wouldn't know compassion. Without evil, we wouldn't know divine mercy. And on that level, we wouldn't be fully human. Think of how important compassion is in our humanity. On that level, you can honestly say we didn't fall down out of Eden, we fell up.
Well, that's true, too. Sometimes you wonder about that compassion, though, Ken. You know that? Sometimes you wonder if it's here at all.
Well, yeah, of course you do. But it gets back then into the question of, is there an independent evil agency headed by this independent evil being? That's one way you can look at it. Islam also looks at it that way. So does Christianity. This is like the force and the dark side. These are powers that are at war in our universe. But I have to tell you, on the other side, Judaism, in the same way that it suppressed these apocryphal books, did not want them in the biblical canon, it says, Now, wait a second. Yes, we recognize evil. We recognize the power of evil. But Satan is not so much a title of an individual as it is an office that anybody can hold. You know, anybody could be mayor. Anybody could be a congressman. It's an office that can be inhabited by anybody, not just one anti-God being. And so Judaism tries to equate that office with one side of our character, namely our evil inclination, that we create, as it were, our own evil, that we do this by our own choice and our free will, so that Satan is really just an aspect of ourselves, of our own being.
Do you believe in hell, in that it might be some place?
Another amazing, fascinating question we could spend hours on. What does the Lost Bible say? That there is one, and it paints it graphically. Now, people are often shocked to discover that traditional Hebrew Bibles, that is the Old Testament, that is most of the Bible. If you accept the New Testament, even so, there are 39 books in the Old Testament, only 27 in the New. That's the bulk of it. And people are shocked that the Bible says that the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, says virtually nothing about the hereafter, heaven or hell, nothing at all. Wow. So where did ideas of heaven and hell come from? They were out there in the contemporary traditions, in the theology. It was what people talked about around the campfire at night. They just didn't write it down. It subsequently came into these books of the Lost Bible, and it says a lot about heaven and hell. Adam, whom we were talking about, we're told that finally, when he passes away, he is very carefully taken up into the third heaven. Again, emphasizing just the compassion and the love and the care he's to inherit this new world where there is no pain and sickness and death. And then what about hell? Oh.
Yeah.
We end up with Dante's Inferno in these pages of the Lost Bible. When Jesus of Nazareth talks about hell and heaven, he didn't just pull this out of his own spirit, out of his own soul and mind. he was building on this whole tradition, even a literary tradition that floated around for centuries but never made it into the Bible.
Why do they write about fire with hell? It kind of makes you think that maybe it's physically in the center of the planet somewhere.
Well, yeah, I suppose it could be. That certainly fire being one of the elements at the core of the planet itself that on occasion erupts in the form of volcanic explosions, this was not lost on the ancients. And certainly they equated that kind of thing with a place of eternal punishment. And we're told, for example, that the prophet Zechariah is taken up into an apocalypse and carted off by servants of creation who, the Lost Bible tells us, also bring in ungodly souls into this place of punishment. And Zechariah, in terror, begs, please do not give them power over me. And the Spirit replies, do not worry. They will never be able to approach you since you are pure. Pure. Fire also purifies, doesn't it?
It sure does.
But in spite of the torments that are related in these apocryphal books, and some of them are pretty grisly even to talk about on the radio, but in spite of all of that, I find this amazing little tidbit that emphasizes repeatedly, don't worry, you are pure. You are already pure if you dare to believe it. And, you know, I like to tell people that the greatest foe that we have in our existence in this universe isn't death, it's fear.
And the unknown.
The unknown. It's fear, it's the fear of death, the fear of the unknown. And throughout history, from these ancient texts to modern people who have near-death experiences, they come back from these. Usually they've been to a place of paradise, but on occasion, even in modern times, you get people who have hellish experiences. But in the end, they come back and they say that the thing that changes most is fear. They no longer fear to depart this life.
Earlier we talked about extraterrestrial visitations, and you were going to contemplate whether I could squeeze out that thought from you. Let me ask you it in a different way. Probably very normal and natural to assume that this universe is teeming with life that we understand.
I agree. It's designed to bring forth life, and that's the uncanny thing. Even from the standpoint of pure science and astrophysics, there is no other way to look at it.
What if there was such an advanced civilization, and one of their roles was, and let's say they perfected the way to travel, maybe through wormholes or something, but their role was to go to other planets and genetically alter, to increase, but to make humans godlike in that figure of what God is. Mm-hmm. And that was their mission. To me, then, these all these reports of, you know, these visitations and what they saw,
yeah,
could be extraterrestrial. I even sometimes think, Ken, that the three children at the time who saw the visions at Fatima,
mm-hmm,
might have seen an extraterrestrial vision, believe it or not. Now, I'm not being sacrilegious here because I'm a believer in the Creator and everything else, but it's very possible that things like that were going on.
Well, let's put it this way. What does the word extraterrestrial mean?
True. To me, it would be beyond this planet.
Beyond this planet, exactly. That's what it means. And to that extent, what we're looking at here in these banned books, and it's a pity they were all banned, but what we're looking at is encounters with extraterrestrials. That's the only way to describe it. So are these beings from other parts of this physical universe, or are they spirit beings from another dimension? I leave it up to individuals, especially being a professor, right, because we have people from different religious backgrounds. We have people who have no religion at all, and we cannot teach religion per se in a public academic setting. We teach about religion, and then we let individuals make up their mind. I'd have to say the jury is still out, and the best thing to do is to be open-minded and to contemplate.
I think so, too. Or it could be a combination of both. Maybe there was some mystical thing that was going on, and maybe there was this extraterrestrial thing going on.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, you have to step back at some point and say either we take all these accounts and just dismiss them entirely, or we say that there is a metaphysical dimension to human life that puts us in touch with something beyond ourselves. And at that point, no individual can prove it, yay or nay. You cannot get into an argument with a materialist and claim to win, and the materialist cannot get in an argument with someone of spiritual sense, let's put it that way, and prove anything. You either believe it or you do not.
Well, I tell you, you've been enlightening, and we're going to continue this dialogue this hour. We'll take phone calls next hour because lots of people want to talk with you, Ken. But let's talk when we come back from this break about end times. So many people are confused about what that means, whether it's a bad thing or a good thing. Again, does this lost Bible talk about end times, Ken?
We'll talk about that for sure.
Okay, so it is in there.
Oh, my. Yes, yes. It's all these incendiary topics that get people very excited.
How big is this book?
You can't even put a page number on it. It's not one book. These are scores of them.
Okay.
Scores of them, of various genres, and written in various locations over centuries and centuries of time, some from the land of Israel, some beyond, some from Egypt, some of a Gnostic kind of aura about them, some more traditionally Judaic. It's a whole menagerie of writings.
Okay, stay with us then. Dr. Ken Hansen, our guest. Again, you've got to get up to his websites. They're linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Some of the things he's got in there, if you're fascinated with what you're hearing, you're going to love what you see. I'll be back in a moment. We'll talk about end times, and then, as promised, next hour we'll open up the phone lines just for you. Welcome back. Dr. Ken Hansen with us. Ken, let's talk a little bit about end times. What does this lost Bible say?
My goodness. Well, here we have something that's common to the three major monotheistic faiths of the West: Judaism, Christianity, Islam. All agree that there will be an end, just as there has been a beginning. And it's something we really ought not to take for granted, because this is particularly a Western way of looking at our existence. Many ideas, philosophies, religions of the East look at things very differently, try to look for harmony, a continuum, sort of a karma, as opposed to this idea of an end. So I like to tell my students, you know, it is not an easy thing to be a monotheist if you choose this way. It is awesome. You have to count the cost of being a monotheist. The idea, in fact, that history is directional, and then you have to think about your own role in it and the difference that you might make in it if you, in fact, think that there will be an end. There is an entire book of the Lost Bible. I mentioned it before, the Book of Jubilees, which supposedly was dictated to none other than Moses by the angel of the presence, and speaks very much about the end of days. I like to call it the most deterministic book ever written. It divides all of history into 50-year cycles called jubilees. Each cycle is a jubilee, from creation through the patriarchs, Abraham and Isaac, on to Moses, who's actually receiving this account, and finally to the end of all things. And while there are certain apocalyptic prophecies found in traditional Bibles, we have a whole new level here. I'm going to share a little bit from Jubilees in my own modern semi-paraphrase that I've done for readers. the angel of the presence brought the stone tablets containing the periods of time from the creation of the world across the complete number of jubilees until the time when a new heaven and a new earth will be created. Now, it doesn't say how many jubilees there are. It just says the complete number is completed.
And how do you interpret that? As a physically new planet or just maybe a new change within the planet?
I think the ancients thought of a metamorphosis, almost like a caterpillar,
a butterfly,
like a cocoon coming out as a butterfly, a complete metamorphosis of the planet as we know it, but not unrecognizable. Perhaps the butterfly analogy isn't perfect, because this is a situation where you will recognize. It says, all creatures will be brought back to life by the power of heaven and the way of the world. Finally, the temple on Mount Zion in Jerusalem will be restored, and the lights of the heavens will shine for healing, peace, and eternal blessings. And yet, the good is balanced by the bad, the positive with the negative, as we talked about before. It says, the entire world will shake on its foundations. The mountain peaks will be flattened. The sun will not shine, and the moon will be eclipsed by darkness. The oceans will roll backwards, retreating to their own depths. The source of all water will be blocked, and the rivers will dry up. That kind of language is all over the Book of Jubilees. Very deterministic.
It sounds like some kind of a catastrophic event is going to occur.
Well, certainly. And that is also common to the three monotheistic faiths. Judaism, Christianity, Islam say, yes, we are going directionally toward this new age. Call it a messianic age, if you will.
Does it talk about time, Ken, a period that this could occur?
Well, that's the thing. It divides history into these jubilee periods of 50 years, but it does not tell you how many jubilees there are going to be. So that's the mystery, and that means that those who attempt to set dates somehow invariably tend to be frustrated in the end and get it wrong. Hasn't that happened numerous times? One has to be very, very careful and get the big picture rather than focusing on the minutia, trying to link what we read with this event or that event. It was Kierkegaard, the philosopher, who said, you know, history makes sense like a movie run backwards. It's one of the most profound things ever said.
Does this
make sense like a movie run backwards? When you look back at it, you get it, but you don't get it while you're in the middle of it.
No, and sometimes you have to play it back a couple times
exactly
before you get it.
Yeah. But there's agreement among the three faiths that prior to this golden age, when the lion will lay down with the lamb, there's going to be a time of trouble, a time of woe and pain, a time of tribulation in Christianity. Judaism calls it Hevelei HaMashiach, which means the pangs of the Messiah, the birth pangs, as it were, labor, like the whole world in labor to bring forth a better age. That's the thing that must be faced first, and that's the frightful thing.
Does this lost Bible echo the traditional Bible in terms of the Book of Revelation?
Yes, it does. And interestingly, the Book of Revelation is the only real apocalypse that made its way into the New Testament. And the same religious sages and clerics who suppressed so many of these apocryphal books, didn't want them in the Bible, let me tell you, they had trouble with books like Revelation also. Another apocalyptic book, Daniel from the Old Testament, barely made it into the Bible just by the skin of its teeth, because there was such a reticence to go there. It's like,
too
don't
scary.
Want to touch this. This is too incendiary. It can lead people into madness, even.
Too negative. Too scary.
Too scary. So we will keep books like Jubilees out of the canon, thank you. We don't want it there.
Well, how did Revelation sneak in?
Because it was so popular. It was so popular. And it also, I'm convinced, as a scholar, gave clues that were meaningful to people in those days, that they related the book of Revelation to historical events transpiring in the first century all around them. And this is really quite amazing. 20th century, 21st century people have no idea how the book of Revelation dovetails with first century history, and I'm convinced is probably one of the main reasons that Christianity as a Jewish sect in those days survived, because it took certain clues embedded in the book of Revelation quite literally, and this fledgling Jewish sect, as it was in those days, literally hightailed it out of Dodge, that is, the city of Jerusalem, just in the nick of time, so that they did not suffer the catastrophe that befell Jerusalem in the first century, namely the complete destruction of the city and the temple.
Does this Lost Bible talk about wormwood, as the book of Revelation does, which to me is an asteroid or something that comes this way?
That's unique to the book of Revelation.
It is.
That's unique to the book of Revelation, yes. Wormwood, exactly. What does that mean? There are clues that transcend time in the book of Revelation, and then there are clues that are time-driven that actually fit into first-century events. And sometimes the prophecies are cyclical. For example, the wormwood link, the prophecy in the book of Revelation, does seem to have to do with a terrible drought that afflicted the land of Israel in the year 67 of the Common Era, and was responsible for terrible plague, people dying of thirst. The waters dried up, and it was though someone had cast wormwood into the waters, and this historically happened.
When these people, Ken, were writing the Bible, writing the Jubilees, once they were completed with it, once they were finished, do you think they just like rolled them up and put them into these canisters, or did they show them around to the populace there and say, read this, read this? I mean, what do you think happened after they were finished with them?
Yeah, excellent question. Clearly, this was popular stuff. I was almost going to call it pulp fiction, but it wasn't taken as fiction. It was very popular literature. People loved this. They devoured it. They memorized it. They were as anxious to understand these clues about the end time and other things as we are today. Which, again, as I mentioned, is one reason I'm convinced this Judeo-Christian sect, as it were, survived, because they applied these prophecies to their day literally, and they fled in a very timely fashion in the nick of time. But this was hugely popular, and what proves it is the fact that they made their way into the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are at least fragments of many of these apocryphal books scattered among the parchments found in 1947 along the shores of the Dead Sea by a Bedouin shepherd boy. This is uncanny, and some of the fragments are in the original Hebrew and Aramaic. Now I mentioned that these books had been transmitted in Greek, Coptic, Ethiopic, Latin, other languages, and the originals were lost. In other words, we didn't have the original Hebrew and Aramaic that so many of these, such as Jubilees, were written in. We didn't have them. We didn't know until fragments now in the Semitic language were found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Not the whole text, but at least fragments, and proves to us that they were very popular, that they were written in this Semitic dialect, circulated widely. People loved this. Why then were they not transmitted? And it has to do with a number of things, having to do, as I mentioned already, with a fear about ideas of dualism. Let's not give Satan too much attention, or you might think there's two gods, not one. There was a fear of the apocalypticism. Maybe people will go mad if they start trying to set dates on the end of the world. Various fears got into the keepers of the canon, into the sages and clerics, the religious leaders, and they made sure that these books were not copied. And if you just don't copy a text, what happens to it? It crumbled.
You got that right. Was there ever any reference to the year 2012 in any of these writings? That's the Mayan calendar end date.
You'd have to start doing gematria at that point, and I cannot say authoritatively that there is not. But part of the problem, again, is that this material was composed, and we're looking at the Hebrew Apocrypha. This is Hebrew Aramaic that was then translated into Greek, Ethiopic, other languages, and that's what we have today. We've got translations of the originals with just a few fragments from the original among the Dead Sea Scrolls. So if you want to start playing with numerical values, and you've got to go back to the original language, which in most cases we don't have with these texts. That's our big problem.
I keep hearing the name, is it the Lilith?
Yes.
Who is Lilith?
Oh, my goodness. Who is very popular she is in the 21st century. Lilith was, according to the Lost Bible, Adam's first wife. Created not from his side, as was Eve, but co-equally from the dust of the ground. And that says something right there.
Sure,
rather than a secondary creation from his side.
An equal.
There's absolute sense here of being co-equal, a co-equality. His first wife, however, something went wrong, because Adam, the earth creature, as I like to translate, I hate to call him a man even. The idea among the mystics is that this was an androgynous being who had both male and female in him to begin with. Can't even call him him. But once he became a he, the man, the Adam, decided that he didn't like this co-equality business, that he wanted to be predominant over the woman, over Lilith, and he said to her, "Lie beneath me, woman." And she said, "No." In other words, "I want to be on top. Thank you." And Adam became furious and expelled her from Eden. Whereupon she, with all chutzpah, as we say in Hebrew, did the unthinkable. She pronounced the divine name, consisting of four Hebrew letters which are never to be uttered. They are too holy to be pronounced on human lips, and she did it. She pronounced the equivalent of YHWH and was instantly spiritually whisked away, whereupon she subsequently birthed a whole race of demons who persecuted the offspring of Adam's second wife. You see, once he expelled Lilith, he asked for another partner who would, in fact, be submissive this time around.
And then along came Eve.
And in jealousy, Lilith persecuted her offspring, caused the death of babies, even of women in childbirth. This is all in Jewish tradition, even responsible for nocturnal emissions. And so, therefore, young men should be careful about sleeping by themselves, lest they be accosted by the long-haired lady of the night, Lilith. But you can take this literally, or you can also look for the message inside, the inner meaning of it, which I very much encourage people to do. Get on the inside of these texts, bring something to them, and recognize here that we have a strongly feminist message. People have, over history, over time, done terrible damage to the image of women just by reading the first three chapters of Genesis.
That's true.
This text has been taken captive by sexist interpreters and clerics down through the ages who have made women little more than chattel, and that's absolutely true. And here, by extension, whether you take this literally or as all part of a great allegory, what does it say? It tells us the way the ancients intended these texts to be viewed. That in fact we have co-equality, and when you don't look at it this way, you unleash hell, you unleash demonic activity.
Do you believe that Eden was in Iraq by the Euphrates and the Tigris?
Actually, we have found it archaeologically, And I'll tell you where. It's in Aden, the modern land called Aden, where the rivers mentioned have been found, where we have all sorts of little minute descriptions from the Bible that seem to dovetail exactly. So that would be my guess as an academician. Put it in Aden.
Now where
not
is that
you have to take it literally again.
Where is that though, Aden? What spot?
Well, we're talking about a Middle Eastern land, actually, an island land.
So not in Iraq?
No.
Okay.
Although it does mention the Tigris and Euphrates.
But, I mean, we don't have a Middle Eastern place called Aden now, so I don't know where this would be.
Well, let's go on a map, into MapQuest, if we can find it. But there are archaeologists who deal exactly with this sort of thing and try to find locales in the biblical traditions that would match the stories. And not that, again, you have to take them literally, but you do your best to find something that would seem to fit.
All right, now you've challenged me to find it. Aden in Yemen. Did I find it, Ken?
Yes, you certainly did. Actually, it's a port in modern times. Now, what it looked like exactly in antiquity is open to discussion. It's not quite the lush, verdant place it used to be. But what intrigues me as a linguist especially is the interplay between different traditions, Jewish, Christian, Islamic in this case. We go back to the Hebrew root, Eden, and we ask, now, what on earth does this mean? And in Hebrew, frankly, we're stumped. So you have to look to cognate Semitic languages, in this case, Arabic. And sure enough, there is an Arabic root, Adan, which means tranquil, peaceful, tranquility. And lo and behold, there is, in fact, an Islamic tradition which relates Eden with Aden in Yemen, as backed by the Quran.
Wouldn't that be something if that's where it all started?
Wouldn't that be something?
Let's
or even in Islam, they have the tradition that it cannot be found, that it was, it really must be understood now to be in heaven and not on this earth. We're always dealing in metaphysics with this give and take, this tug of war between the literal and the symbolic. And that's the real question.
And what position do you normally take, the literal or the symbolic?
You're trying to pin me down.
This has been a night of trying to circle.
I just try to get people to think, you see. And if I tell people what to think, then I'm not really being a good professor.
Well, no, I don't want you to tell us what to think. I want you to tell us what you think.
I think that we have symbolic ideas that are based upon literal fact, but that embellish them, that take them to another level, because these are metaphysicians. These are ancient mystics in most cases who were writing this stuff, and they're trying to teach us something. So, we can look for literal stuff. We can find it. We can find. I believe that the story of Eden is based on this geography. That's my hunch. I can't prove it. That's my hunch. But it has basis, like so much of folklore has a basis, in fact. That doesn't mean you take the whole thing literally.
And roughly, what time period might this have been, do you think? The Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve?
Well, you go back to the very beginnings of human civilization, and that is in the general area of Mesopotamia. We're going back to about 3,000 plus BCE. At that point, but then what was before? We have in the archaeology we have ancient settlements at Jericho, for example, which goes back fully 9,000 years. That is 7,000 BC, and we also have the speculation that the Sphinx in Egypt may go back as far as 10,000.
That's true. How about the Sumerians? 5,000 BC.
Generally, the development of civilization about 3,000 BC in Sumeria. Still, it seems to have come out of nowhere, It seems to have just flourished incredibly with virtually no foundation. It didn't evolve. It's like it arrived full blown. The essence of Mesopotamian civilization is mind boggling.
Let's go to the calls. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning, George.
Hi.
This is John in Atlanta. And good morning to your guest.
Good morning to you.
I know the Kabbalah speaks of, I believe the term is transmigration of souls.
Yes.
Which has been interpreted as a form of reincarnation. Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder what you have researched in these extra-biblical documents that might refer to the truth of reincarnation, and what are your particular beliefs on this?
Yeah, the idea is that we all stem from the primordial essence of God, that we can all root ourselves in Eden, talking about Eden, and that the souls that were created then found their way from the beginning, even from before creation, found their way into human flesh, and then then transmigrated from one generation to the next all in the direction of purification. So many of the mystics, rather than talking about hellish punishment, would prefer to think about another cycle. The soul must come back, must be purified, until finally someday we reach the messianic age. And we do have a sense in the Lost Bible in places of the idea of a pre-existence of the soul, that we came from someplace beyond and were put down here into human bodies, and that is a strong concept in the Lost Bible.
Do you think that when the canon of Scripture was laid down, there was a specific intent to omit these particular beliefs?
Yes. there was a specific intent to omit a lot of the beliefs that we have referenced here tonight.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And it's a shame, because I like the idea of an openness. You trot out ideas, and you don't say this is the only way to think. You allow for variation, for people to go in different directions and make their own choices about what they want to believe. But you have to have options for people. And sure enough, when you put religious leaders in charge, they are going to try invariably to standardize and to suppress everything they don't agree with. This is exactly what happened. There were various councils in Christianity, for example, which ultimately gave us the canon that we have today. But this didn't take place for centuries, even after Jesus. It took that long for there even to be a general agreement about which books would be included. And in the Jewish world, the same thing is true. The books I'm talking about tonight were generally accepted as canon in the first 2 centuries B.C., and it took until a rabbinical council at a Mediterranean town called Yavne in Palestine around 90 CE for the rabbis to get together and say it will only be these books and nothing more, and we're going to suppress the ones that seem to be too far out, too far-fetched. And I have to chuckle about the idea of suppressing a book for being far-fetched when we've got in the Bible itself, we've got stories of the sun standing still, of the Red Sea splitting apart. I mean, fantastic things that were allowed to be part of the canon. Why suppress this material?
Are you familiar at all, Ken, with the work of John Allegro?
Yes, I am.
What do you think of his, I guess, could you call them theories or work?
Well, he began his legacy as a fine young scholar of the Dead Sea Scrolls, very importantly. And he worked on one of the most fascinating of the Dead Sea Scrolls, as far as I'm concerned, the Copper Scroll. This was the one Dead Sea Scroll completely different from all of the others, because it was not composed of parchment or animal skins like these other documents, but the contents were pounded into sheets of pure and highly refined copper, and then riveted one into another, rolled up, left in the desert for 2 millennia. And the contents are equally astounding. It's an inventory of buried treasure, more than 200 tons of gold and silver and consecrated artifacts from the sacred temple in Jerusalem, as well as precise locations as to where this stuff was buried in the wilderness of Judea. And Allegro and some others worked on the Copper Scroll. They actually mounted an expedition to go out there and see what they could uncover. To date, not a trace has ever come to light. And it's one of the enduring mysteries of this whole mysterious saga.
West of the Rockies, you're up with Dr. Ken Hansen. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Dr. Hansen.
Hi there.
This is Tammy here in Spokane, Drought State, Washington.
Sure thing. Go ahead, Tammy.
I had a couple phenomena, one with a question and one when I was carrying my child. Honestly, never considered names or anything, wanted a healthy child, and spiritual at the time, and still am if I remember. But I'm in recovery, and Mom says, what are you going to name her? And I knew if I listened for a second, the name, she would get the perfect name. And it was Tracy. It was right then. And it was interesting because I spelled it with an I, and my name also ends with an I. But I just wanted to share that with you. I could listen to Dr. Hansen always. And I have an opinion also and a question. My opinion, or a thought, with the trouble we're having these days in our flag salute, why not, instead of one nation under God, why not one nation without greed? Just an opinion and a thought of mine.
Good luck on that one, right?
I hope a lot of people hear it. And
your question. Go ahead with your question.
I haven't heard you speak about tongues, and if there's anything, I had a phenomenon with that, and just wondered.
Tongues? Speaking in tongues?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. This is one of those metaphysical phenomena that people associate exclusively with the New Testament, specifically the Book of Acts and the writings of Paul that depict this phenomenon, a speaking in unknown languages. And it's a practice that obviously is carried on today by millions of evangelical Christians around the world. It linked to the whole phenomenon of prophecy. What people don't realize is that there are roots to this phenomenon beyond the New Testament. There were people across the ancient Near East, for example, in Greece. The oracles of Greece clearly spoke in an ecstatic kind of language and delivered prophetic messages. And the impartial observer would look at this and say that this is definitely an example of speaking in tongues. But then you go into the Hebrew side of things, and you look at the word prophesy itself in Hebrew. The root is niba, to prophesy. But what it actually means is to utter forth, just to utter forth. It doesn't necessarily imply anything intelligible. And you look at the very earliest prophets recorded in the Hebrew Bible, and they seem to have been a rather strange, ecstatic band of wanderers, of oracles, who did some pretty strange, bizarre things, and among them included an ecstatic utterance. It will say, for example, that Saul, before he became king, he fell on the ground naked and lay there prophesying. It doesn't say he gave a message. It just says, niba, uttering forth. So the observer looks at this and says, sure sounds like what we would call speaking in tongues, an ecstatic utterance going way back into the ancient world, well before the New Testament. So you look at all this as metaphysical experience, and you say that one seems to bolster the other. Rather than just dismissing it all, you say, by golly, there's a trend here.
You know, what's incredible too, Ken, is so many people have interpreted all these texts as being religious as opposed to being incredible stories of mankind, mm-hmm. and you know, the beginning of life and things like that. And
right.
I wish more people would understand that these are almost scientific books subject
sure.
to interpretation as opposed to religious.
And on one level, metaphysical. I hate to use the word religious, to be honest, because it implies theology.
Yes, you're right.
And one good thing to say about Judaism, by the way, is that it doesn't really have a theology. It doesn't have one. It regulates behavior, how you treat one another, right? What was the suggestion? Instead of one nation under God?
One nation without greed,
kind,
right?
Be kind to one another is what the message of Judaism is. It doesn't tell you what to believe. It's open, which I'm afraid is why I'm a little slippery in terms of being pinned down.
Yes, you are.
It doesn't require you to give assent to any a series of brittle doctrines. That's the value of it, in my estimation. Anyway, what were we talking about?
Well, we're taking phone calls. So let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning to you. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from a little bitty town called El Reno, Oklahoma.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, I wanted to just describe an experience that happened to me. This was like maybe way back in the 80s.
Sure.
And I was attacked by demonic forces, but what I'm trying to do is get an explanation of what happened, either like from a spiritual or scientific or some kind of point of view. But what happened, see, I suffer from muscular dystrophy, so I'm not able to, like, move quickly and all
right,
of that because
right.
I'm real weak. So anyway, I was laying in my bed one night. This was back when I was married. And my wife was beside me, and I had checked all the doors and made sure they were locked. Door to the bedroom was locked. Okay, so I went on to sleep, and I was laying on my back. And about maybe 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, something woke me up. And what woke me up was I felt something squeezing my ankles. And I mean, it was painful. So when I woke up, I knew nobody could be in the house, so I didn't move quickly. I just barely opened my eyes and looked at my ankles to see if there was anybody really there. And the foot of my bed was about maybe 6, 7 feet from the door to the bedroom. So anyway, when I looked, I saw these hands, but they weren't hands like you and I have. These were hands like huge grizzly bear paws, and they were squeezing my ankle so much that, it was killing me.
Could you see where the hands were connected?
Sure. My eyes slowly panned from the, hands to the wrist to the forearm and
yeah.
all of that, and I noticed whatever this was dressed in a monk's robe, like a dark brown monk's
yeah.
robe with a hood on it, but it didn't have the hood on it. So by the time... Excuse me, I'm a little bit nervous. But by the time my eyes panned upward to the chest, I could see that this thing was so massive that all of the light that would have been coming in from outside was blotted out. It just completely covered the doorway. And as my eyes panned up to the chest and the head, I saw that the head was like...
You got to do me a favor. When you yep. do that, you got to move your mouth from the phone.
Okay, I apologize,
okay?
sir.
All right.
Okay, but when the... When my eyes saw the head, it had a head like those, like American werewolves in London kind of picture.
Yeah.
Had a head just like that, and the fur was all matted and stuff. And by then, I was so terrified I couldn't move. Okay, but I heard a voice right up above my head about a foot to the left. And this voice said, man, you don't have to worry. All you have to do is do what I taught you. And I'm wondering, well, what voice is this? What did you teach me? And just then I had a flashback in my mind of when I was watching TBN one day, and this man said, whenever you encounter those demonic forces, just say in the name of Jesus, I bind you up and cast you back to the driveway.
All right, when we come back from this break, and I want you to listen on the radio to Dr. Ken Hansen's answer when we come back, maybe he can tell us what that creature might have been, what that demonic force could have been. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Ken Hansen, what do you think that creature might have been that was holding that guy's ankles down?
Yeah, well, good question. I think that whatever it is, it is a link, as so much metaphysical experience is a link to the archetypal world, the world of being, as I like to call it. It's a mirrored reflection of activity in the supernatural realm. And the most important thing is not to become terrified, to become freaked out, to think there's something wrong with me, because when, especially we looked at these ancient books, we realized that these kind of metaphysical experiences are universal, they're across the centuries. You recognize that we live on a battleground, that we live in struggle, and the struggle is often with ourselves. In this case, I'm very much interested in this image of not only the claws, but the monk, and it seems to be some kind of a religious image. And a lot of people struggle very much with religion and with the role of religion. And sadly, it's a terrifying thing for a lot of people. It instills fear when it ought not to. And you know, Jacob, we're told, wrestled with an angel, but he did not give up, and he prevailed. And I think that if we understand that spiritual battleground, we can take charge in a situation. I'm reminded of a Christian, very famous Christian preacher named Smith Wigglesworth, who had a similar metaphysical experience of some kind of presence at the very foot of his bed in the middle of the night. And he felt this was the evil one who had somehow incarnated. And suddenly, very quickly, he lit his candle, and he looked at the foot of his bed, and sure enough, it was this demonic figure. And what did he do? He said, "Oh, it's only you," and blew out the candle.
Only you.
It's only you.
And what was his last name?
Wigglesworth. Smith Wigglesworth. True story. Very famous.
But
here was one who was not perturbed by the fact that forces exist. It's a battleground. Whether you're a Muslim, Christian, Jewish, the Talmud surprises a lot of Jewish people. The Talmud is full of demons. Full of them. But it treats them like flies. Right? Just like nuisances. You swat them away. And the thing that you learn is to understand the reflection of the struggles that we feel. And in this case, all I can think of is some kind of struggle with religion.
Let's go to the phones again. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Hi.
Good morning. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning to you.
My name is Nathan. I'm from Columbus, Ohio. One thing that fascinates me about this subject that I've recently started to get into was alchemy, the ascension process, and the platinum group. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Somewhat.
The monatomic gold that I believe is mentioned in the Bible in Revelation chapter 2, verses 17.
The white powder of gold.
Yes.
Yep.
I was wondering if you could shed some light on that. There seems to be a lot of different areas that point to this. For instance, Nostradamus saying that the occult gold would be rediscovered by 99, which I believe he might be referring to David Hudson and his patents in the early 90s. And Jesus, I believe, spoke a lot about not necessarily the monatomic gold, but things that relate to that.
All right, let's find out. There was something mystical about this white powder of gold, Ken, and I don't know if in any of your research you've come across that.
I've come across a lot of imagery of gold and the power of gold, the spiritual power. For example, we have an amazing vision in one of these suppressed texts in which an ancient leader of Judea, his name is Judah, he has a dream, he has a vision, and he's given a sword by the prophet Jeremiah, and the sword is pure gold, and with it he takes it in his hand and goes out and slays the enemy general and severs his head. But it's interesting that Jeremiah is the one who, according to the Lost Bible, hid away the Ark of the Covenant, not to be discovered again until the very end of days, which of course is golden also. And its power, as it were emanates even prior to its rediscovery at the end of days. All you have to do is tap into it, and there is the power of this golden chest. But I think Revelation, whenever it references gold, is on that same wavelength. Here is purity, almost an electric magnetic power, such as came forth from the Ark of the Covenant. And the idea, again, in the end of days, this is to be revealed.
You've provided us some great imagery, which we have on the coasttocoastam.com website. And if you have a computer, just go up there and take a look at it under the feature article. Great artwork indeed by a French artist, Gustave, is it Gustave Doré?
Yes, indeed. and so, really some of my favorite work as well. And these etchings also appear in my book, Secrets from the Lost Bible. And I ought to mention, by the way, that this material is something that I've tried to bring to life even beyond literary pages. I've put together an entire one-man show that dramatizes the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the amazing literature and the lost books in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I call it Jerusalem Jones and the mystery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I even have a backup band that goes around the country with me. And we're having a great time. believe it or not, we have a backup band. We turned it musical even. Because, I mean, why not? We want to get this gold, this hidden gold, out into the public domain. And I also take trips to the land of Israel and discovery trips. My band has some albums also, some CDs that are out there on the website.
Very good. That's interesting.
What's
it sound like?
What's the music sound like?
Yeah.
This is Central Florida's Pink Floyd, basically. That nails it. They've been called the Central Florida Pink Floyd, and they provide my backup music, original scores, sound effects. We take you through the discovery of these documents out in the desert in 1947 and beyond.
That's fascinating. Next time, get me a CD. We'll play some clips on the show.
All right. Sounds excellent.
Wildcard Line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
We are well. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Miami, Florida.
Okay.
My name is Brian.
Brian, it's all yours. Go ahead.
Okay. George, thanks for having a wonderful show.
You are welcome.
And Kenneth, thanks for making us all think.
All right. That's my job. I think, a professor.
Yeah. My question is back to Lilith. If they were both born out of the dirt, were they both born at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
Or was one born first? And there's actually a second question that goes on, but
well, to answer the first one, no, the same time, from co-equal from the dust of the ground, and Lilith knew it as well, so she's become quite a symbol for feminism in the modern world. Let's hear it for Lilith.
Okay, so as far as that goes, though, does that introduce a dichotomy as far as God goes, or the four-letter word which, I don't know, all of us Christians or recovering Christians or whatever say is Yahweh, is that a dichotomy, or should Adam, with her being cast out as her being the lesser, was that God's way of saying that there should only be one God? That as far as with all of us being being born in his image, both male and female, by the way, being born in his image, that there should only be one.
One deity.
Exactly.
The mystics really get into this, the Kabbalistic folks down through the ages, and see the original Adam as androgynous, both male and female, and then the female traits are separated out, both co-equal, but needing one another. And so when they come back together in union and in sexual union as well, when they come back together, they express the original unity of the divine. So Judaism must always be supremely monotheistic. There is only one deity, but that deity is expressed in male and female. So to that extent, you've got a dichotomy, and the biblical text is very sexual, very much stresses male and female in everything. But bring them together, and the Lost Bible gets into that, and even in the Gospel of Thomas, which is similar to perhaps a missing Q text, the actual sayings and words of Jesus. So scholars talk about a missing text of the sayings of Jesus called Q. This Gospel of Thomas may be that, or something like that, but I mentioned it because there's a curious passage there which says, wherever you find two, make of them one. Wherever you find two, make of them one. Make the two one. And that's the idea behind Genesis, behind union.
Does the Lost Bible talk about Noah's Ark and where it might
be? Yes. back with this whole thing about the Nephilim and the giants. And Noah, by the way, according to the Lost Bible, his father, Lamech, is very worried that Noah himself might be the product of this union between the giants and the earth women. And goes and talks to his father Methuselah, who in turn goes up into the heavens, another out-of-body experience or an extraterrestrial experience, whatever, and talks to Enoch, who is up into the heavens. And Enoch assures him that, that Noah is, in fact, fully earthly and is not some hybrid union from the extraterrestrials, and that, that the flood is going to come. Yes, it's a judgment, but it's going to put an end to this, this terrible disaster that has befallen the planet.
West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Hello, George, and hello, Doctor.
Hi.
Hello there.
How are you? This is David in Phoenix.
Go ahead, David.
Hi, David.
Y'all put
go
on
ahead.
A
go
very
ahead,
good
David.
Show tonight.
That's okay, my friend. Go ahead with your question, because the clock's going to get us tonight.
Gotcha, gotcha. Basically, what I was trying to, I was just trying to relay an experience I had about 18 years ago. I was in a coma for 6 weeks. And I had died three times while in the coma. And I had three visions while I was in the coma. And, I mean, all my major organs had failed. My lungs had collapsed. And I was dead. They were going to pull the plug. And my mother had called the Catholic priest to administer last rites. And a woman from Germany, same hometown in Germany that my grandfather had come from, walked in the room and said, you're not supposed to pull the plug. He's going to live. God has something for him to do. But I was trying to tie this in with Terry in Florida. I mean, I was dead. They declared me brain dead. And I believe God is all-powerful and that man does not have the right to decide who lives and who dies. That's not given to us. Mm-hmm. Although, unfortunately, the choice is made many times each day around this world.
Well, that is true indeed, yes. Daniel, David. True indeed.
Remarkable account.
Of everything that you studied with this lost Bible, was there any one thing, Ken, that stood out, that confounded you, that fascinated you?
More than anything else is who we are, and this comes home very personally to me because from my own religious background, I found that if religious people, if religious leaders in particular, can convince you that you're really a mess, that you really have problems, for example, can exploit your inherent insecurity, it's very easy to control people. You can be controlled even in the most well-intentioned religious environments. And there are plenty of such examples all around us, tend to be in fundamentalist circles. But, yeah, you convince people that they're worthless, that they're nothing more than dust, and that they're a mess, and you can control them. And the thing that blew me away more than anything else is the incessant depiction of the divinity of the human being. It sounds almost blasphemous to say that, but to have such a God consciousness, to recognize simply who you are, it is liberating, because when you know that, when you have that knowledge, there's nobody who can control you. You're self-sufficient. You don't lack anything. You don't need to do anything to justify yourself either. You can employ a little bit of Zen, and I'm reminded of this saying. It's common to proclaim, hey, don't just sit there, do something. The Lost Bible, just like Zen, turns it around sometimes and says, don't need to do anything, sit there. Sit there, realize who you are, recognize the reality of the divine in you, and nobody can control you.
Well, the one thing I do understand, Ken, and truly believe, is that a long time ago on this planet, some kind of marvelous events occurred, supernatural, metaphysical, maybe a combination of everything, maybe even visits from extraterrestrials, as we talked about, but whatever happened, it was truly so profound that it has affected all of us and probably will be until the end of time.
Absolutely. It is a mysterious universe, and we dare not think in all of our rationality that we've got it nailed down.
No, not at all. What's next on your plate in the next year or so?
In the next year, I am going to be going back repeatedly, I hope, to the land of Israel, doing some real adventure travels with very small groups, no more than 10, rather than big mega groups. I want to cap this and have like a portable classroom and let individuals in the groups tell me where they want to go, what they want to learn, and we'll take off in a van and just go.
Maybe you'll find the Ark of the Covenant, huh?
Bring your metal detector.
I love it. Thanks, Ken. You take care.
You too, George.
That's Dr. Ken Hansen. If you need to email me, of course, it's always George at coasttocoastam.com.